killing me when I'm in the street. I keep thinking, what if I get shot dead? Who will take care of my children then?
The Princess of Wales apologises for digitally manipulating the first official photograph since her recent operation. And the airline passenger who saw others pinned to the ceiling as their plane suddenly plunged.
And the pilot came to the back and I said, what happened? And he said, my instrument panel went blank. There was no turbulence, no nothing. The whole thing just stopped.
First the news.
Hello, I'm Emily Thomas with the BBC News. The Israeli offensive in Gaza continues unabated on the first day of the fasting month of Ramadan. Palestinian health officials say 16 people were killed and many wounded in an airstrike on a house in Gaza City. In central Gaza, the Israeli military said it killed 15 militants in close combat and airstrikes. Yoland Nell is in Jerusalem.
The fighting remains very intense, particularly in the south around Khan Yunis. There have even been strikes around Rafah. This all adds, of course, to the real concern about what happens next. We had the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu saying on Sunday that Israel would press ahead with an offensive in the south of the Gaza Strip, a move that the US President Joe Biden had described as being his red line. So, of course, that is going to worry different international players, because if Israel is to go into Rafah, particularly during Ramadan, that could really inflame tensions around the region.
The World Food Programme has warned that people in the Haitian capital are facing famine conditions as the security situation deteriorates. Armed gangs have seized control of much of the city, and reports say food stores have been looted. Jean-Martin Bauer, a WFP representative in Haiti, said 1.6 million people in Port-au-Prince were in dire straits.
I remind you that you've got more than 360,000 Haitians who've been displaced by the violence. That's essentially a doubling of the numbers in the past few months. And this population that's been displaced has lost everything. Often their houses have been burned by the armed groups. People are on the move and have no resources.
A Nigerian government agency says schools in at least 14 out of the country's 36 states, as well as the capital, Abuja, are at risk of attacks following the recent kidnapping of hundreds of students. The agency, Financing Safe Schools in Nigeria, was formed after the abduction of girls from Chibok in Borno State in 2014. It said security around school premises would be heightened. The Princess of Wales has acknowledged editing a family photograph that was issued by Kensington Palace on Sunday. The picture was the first to be released since she had abdominal surgery in January, but news agencies later withdrew it because of concerns it could have been manipulated. Here's Sarah Campbell.
When this photograph dropped yesterday, the idea being to reassure the public that, as Kensington Palace have always said, Catherine is doing well after her operation, which is almost 2 months ago now. But as soon as those inconsistencies in the photograph really started to be picked up, social media was alight with all these conspiracy theories because of the fact she hasn't appeared in public since then. There are a lot of calls online for the original, unedited photograph to be published. At the moment, Kensington Palace are saying that's not likely to happen.
You're listening to the latest world news.
WORT would like to thank the following local restaurants and businesses who provided meals for our hardworking volunteers during our recent winter pledge drive. Bandung, Banzo, Cardinal Bar, Cooper's Tavern, Einstein's Coffee and Bagels, Glass Nickel Pizza West, Hong Kong Cafe, Ian's Pizza on State Street and Francis Street, Just Veggies, Lao Lang Zong, Migrants Madison, Melio's on MLK, Original Pancake House on University Ave, Pizza Bruta, Soups I Did It Again in Spring Green, Teddy Wedgers, Weary Traveler Free House, Wilma's Fund LGBT Assistance, and the Willie Street Co-op. WORT would like to extend our gratitude to these restaurants for helping to put the community in WORT Community Radio through their donations of food. Gratefully yours for nearly five decades, this is WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Budget Bicycle Center's used bicycle showroom located at 930 Regent Street. Open for curbside service estimates and sales, 251-1663. More information on Budget Bicycles services for new and used bicycles is available on the web at budgetbicyclectr.com.
Good morning. It is 8:06, and you are tuned to the Monday 8 o'clock buzz on WORT 89.9 FM Madison and WORTFM.org. This is Brian Standing. The Wisconsin legislature moves to make it easier to find out who's funding your politicians. Reporter Jacob Resnick from Wisconsin Watch has the story. And not only is the decimal point 150 years older than previously thought, but it's Italian, not German. Trinity Western University mathematician Glenn Van Brummelen tells us about his discovery. And finally, got an idea that would look good on the walls of the WORT studios? Well, now's your chance. Phil Ryan joins us to tell us all about the new WORT mural project. We'll have all that, plus some announcements, the Outdoor Adventure Report, a look at the weather, and some tasty tunes served up by our engineer, Rudy Nundy. All that's coming up right after this. It's 8:09. You're tuned to the 8 o'clock buzz on WORT. This is Brian Standing. As Wisconsin gears up to vote in local, state, and federal elections, a raft of bipartisan election and campaign reform bills are under consideration by the Wisconsin legislature. Many of those bills continue to languish and seem unlikely to pass, yet one bill did emerge from the process. Senate Bill 822 would centralize and standardize campaign finance reporting with the Wisconsin Ethics Board. On February 23rd, the Wisconsin Senate concurred with assembly amendments and adopted the final bill, which now heads to the governor's desk. Wisconsin Watch reporter Jacob Resnick has been tracking this story, and he joins us now. Welcome back to the 8 o'clock buzz.
Good morning.
So when you wrote your article, it was a couple days before the 23rd, you were writing about how this particular bill was still languishing in the assembly. Do you think your reporting helped embarrass the legislature into passing it after all?
I can't take credit for that. All we can do is try to raise awareness, for pieces of legislation, when we get later in the session that are competing for legislators' time and bring it to the public's attention. So we'll see how far this bill actually gets. We can be cautiously optimistic at this point.
So what still needs to happen with this bill? It seems like it passed the assembly and passed the Senate. Is there still another step for this to take?
This is embarrassing because the last time I checked, and I'm actually on the legislature's website right now, I had seen that it was still in the Committee on Campaign and Elections, awaiting to be exact out of there. In your intro, you made it sound like they had perhaps moved it to another bill, maybe. You're correct. Senate Bill 822 did pass, and the Assembly's version is Assembly Bill 853. And last I checked with staff and looking on their website, unless something happened in the 11th hour, like over the weekend, it's still awaiting to be quote exec and voted on the assembly floor.
Okay, so it's getting closer, but still not quite through the morass yet. So what would this bill do, and why is it important?
Well, you know they say all politics is local. We put so much attention on national elections, statewide elections, but often, you know, I would argue as, you know, a reporter, we don't look enough at what's happening for the people who make the decisions that a lot of really affect our daily lives, and that's like the school board level and the city council or village board, things like that. And one of the problems is the oversight of, you know, campaign finance, who's funding these, you know, who's behind these candidates, who pays for the flashy lawn signs, things like that. It can often be very difficult to know, especially if you don't have like a robust local newspaper or radio station, television station that's like tracking who these candidates are. And often you just hear their names, and maybe if you're lucky, there'll be a display ad in the newspaper or a radio ad or something, but you often don't know what's going on. You know, but you can get answers to these questions through the campaign filings. Not only who's, you know, on their committees tracking their money, but who's been writing them checks. And unfortunately, in Wisconsin, unlike statewide offices, local officials aren't required to put anything on a website. It's usually held by county clerks. In my experience, you ask to see those filings, they'll want to charge you money. They'll want to print you out hard copies. You'll have to drive down, to the courthouse in the middle of the afternoon and find parking. And, you know, and that's beyond the pale for, you know, the average voter. And I don't blame them. What this would do would centralize the process. So everyone who runs for a local office from school board on up would file with the Wisconsin the Wisconsin Ethics Commission. And it'd be a lot easier to request this kind of, you know, information.
So is the there may be some folks who would trust their local clerk more than they would trust a state agency, in recent years with the amount of partisanship that's occurred at the state legislature. What would make the Wisconsin Ethics Board reliable?
Well, it's important to outline that it doesn't actually change what the filing requirements are. It's more about where it's located. And the Ethics Commission, they're a lot better. They have a lot more advanced content system. So it's easier to call them or email them and ask for the documents, and they don't charge anything. Whereas local clerks are often burdened with so many other tasks and mandates that they have to do, you know, they are arguably, especially in smaller towns, don't have the time to handle all these requests. It's better. The argument is it's better to professionalize the system. It's not a matter that, you know, there would be like a bad actor or untruthful or something like that. It's just better to have people whose own, you know, they have one job and one job to do it well, which is to keep track of this stuff and have it so it's, you know, easy to request.
So I think there's a perception among many that, you know, the sort of money, the dark money that we see in federal and state elections, there's a perception at least that it hasn't quite trickled down to the local level yet. Is that perception accurate, or don't we know because we don't have access to these reports?
Well, there has been some good reporting in the last election cycle that there have been national networks and, you know, arguably dark money groups that have been affecting things like school board elections. There's ideologically driven groups that have gone to elect school board members who, and because it's not easy to see who's filing this, you know, to get their filings, it's easy for them to run a very, you know, bland, yet flashy campaign, and people not realize, oh, there's some network with a, you know, out-of-state address that just, you know, wrote them a check for $2,500, which could be, you know, a small fortune in a school board race, right? So arguably, it's already happened, and unfortunately, the way our campaign finance laws are and the way the courts have been working, it's not looking like it's going to be getting any better soon. So the best shield we have really to this is just more transparency.
So as a reporter, how do you use these kinds of reports?
You see who is writing them checks. You can see who is in their local organizing committee, who their treasurer is. You know, then you can put those names in a search engine. And you can see what kind of, you know, business interests they might have. I mean, for example, if there's a if there's a city council election and you see that all the people writing checks are, you know, from the real estate industry, that might tell you something. Oh, this person might be very pro-development. And, you know, that can be that's not necessarily a bad thing, but, you know, it's instructive to the kind of people who are backing that certain candidate. Or you can see, oh, this person's getting money from people who are active in one political party or the other, even though the elections are not, are, you know, nominally nonpartisan. It can be instructive. So, you know, I would say, Brian, you know, just the forms themselves probably won't mean a lot to the ordinary person. But for people who do watch these things in places where they have, you know, reporters and citizens groups and things like that, I think having the information more readily available will allow like a more informed electorate, because it will percolate down to the voter.
And how did this particular bill come together in the legislature?
Well, it was bipartisan. It really didn't have much opposition. All it really does, I mean, it's pretty vanilla. I mean, all it does is it takes the same filing requirements and centralizes it. So, you know, you don't have all the different kinds of clerks having to do this. You know, you can just go to one-stop shop and go to the ethics commission. What it doesn't do, and we outlined this in our we did a short report on this for Wisconsin Watch, it doesn't expand the statement of economic interest requirements. And if it's okay if I talk about that for a
second. Yes, please do.
So those are really interesting documents, and every lawmaker in the state has it, every district attorney, basically every statewide officer, from the governor all the way down to like advisory boards who look for like snowmobile trails, you know, and such. They have to file, you know, it shows what their day jobs are, or if they have a day job, where their investments are, and basically where the money comes from. And that's really important to make sure that there aren't potential conflicts of interest, okay? Now, whether county or city officials have to file one of those, it really depends on the locality. So in the county I live in, Winnebago County, for example, county officials like the sheriff and so forth don't have to file these things. If you go across the county line up to Appleton and Outagamie County, for example, they do have to file these. As a transparency advocate, I would say it would be really important to standardize that requirement. So everyone who's running for public office in Wisconsin would file a statement of economic interest, so you know where, you know, how they make their money, and, you know, if there would be any potential conflicts. This bill doesn't go that far. It doesn't make that requirement universal. It's still a patchwork, but I just want to highlight that because that's one thing that the Ethics Commission does a very good job for. Unfortunately, you have to request it. They don't just post on there, but if you write them an email and say, hey, I'm looking for this person, they will send you their statement of economic interest, and then you can see, you know, where their money is coming from. And that can be very instructive to the type of person who's holding public office.
Is there any legislative activity to expand those economic interest statements?
If there is, I have not been able to find it, but it's just something that, you know, as a transparency advocate, I have been talking, you know, I'd like to highlight, because it seems like it'd be a very simple fix.
And perhaps this will lay the framework for further reforms in the future then.
We can hope.
What are some of the other things that you're tracking in the legislature related to transparency?
Well, there also is a bill that is going in front of the governor, and it would allow police departments to charge money for the time spent to redact body cam footage. And this is something that there's been the Freedom of Information Council, for example, has put a bunch of red flags on, because if there's a critical incident that's involving, you know, an injury or a death, you know, reporters and other transparency groups will request the body cam footage. You know, body cams came in, you know, about a decade ago, lauding, you know, new transparency for police actions. As it stands now, they sometimes have to fuzz out witnesses and things like that to comply with victims' rights statutes. This would allow, after a certain amount of requests, for them to charge the staff time to do that. And that would basically, in effect, make it prohibitively expensive to get the body cam footage of a critical incident, you know, for most people and, frankly, most media organizations. So that is a bill that has passed bipartisan, again, with largely Democratic support as well, and it's headed to the governor. And There has been outcry from Freedom of Information Council, groups like ACLU, things like that, urging the governor not to sign it.
Any indication yet from the governor's office which way he's leaning?
No, actually, there hasn't. This one has kind of gone kind of under the radar. There's been a couple columns written about it. This bill, Senate Bill 789. An open letter went out, I think, a week and a half ago. And we're hoping that the governor takes a hard look at it before it becomes law, just because it could really put body cam footage out of reach for most everyday folks.
And what's the rationale for allowing these kinds of charges?
The rationale is that it's cumbersome for police agencies. The police groups have said that their staff are spending more and more time to fill these kinds of requests. And they say that some of them aren't in transparency, like good faith, that some of them are basically commercial organizations that are just trying to like make YouTube channels and monetize, you know, what are often tragic things like that. So the bill has some language in there saying if it's for a for-profit organization, then they would be able to charge for it. Unfortunately, I work for a nonprofit news organization, but still, arguably, I'd say that that's problematic because, you know, most of the newspapers and radio and TV stations in the state are for-profit, and so you shouldn't really, pick who can have access to what is a public document and what's not. They're just saying it's burdensome, and that they warn that if they have to spend too much staff time redacting these, that they might just stop using body cams altogether. Transparency groups argue that, you know, yes, it might be a pain in the neck, but it is actually still part of your job, and that, you know, fulfilling public records is a key responsibility for public officials. And even if, you know, that's not their favorite task, it's something that they have to do in the service of the public.
All right. We've been speaking with Wisconsin Watch reporter Jacob Resnick. You can read Jacob's reporting on wisconsinwatch.org. Thank you for joining us on the 8 o'clock buzz.
Hey, my pleasure.
We'll be back with the Outdoor Adventure Report and the Song of the Week coming up right after this. It's 8:24. You're tuned to the 8 o'clock buzz. This is Brian Standing. This is WORT. It's time once again to take a look at the things happening out in the great outdoors at the Outdoor Adventure Report with Master Naturalist Paul Nuldner. Take it away, Paul.
Thank you, Brother Brian and WORT for covering all things natural. While walking the pups this morning, I saw pairs of robins, mourning doves, chickadees, and woodpeckers. It's apparently spring. Your weekly Outdoor Adventure Report is brought to you by Paul Nuldner with Madison Fund, Friends of Urban Nature, a partnership of local parks, environmental, and Friends of Parks groups helping connect Madison communities and kids with nearby nature all year round. Enjoy free, fun, welcoming, diverse, accessible, family and kid-friendly, naturalist-guided, educational adventures every week with many other great outings and events in Madison Parks, hosted by local nature groups. Outings are free with no registration unless noted. No special equipment is needed to enjoy nature and the great outdoors. Just show up and join the fun. This past week, people celebrated the 50th anniversary of Elder Leopold Sand County Almanac with a series of talks and walks. Formed a new Friends of Harper Road Prairie group to help restore prairie and Mendota mental health. Enjoyed poetry about environmental justice and social justice at How Art Speaks Through Nature with Madison poet laureate Angie Trudell-Vesquez. And learned what environmental restoration means to Native cultures at a free viewing of Maya Land, Listening to the Bees. Nature enthusiasts also learned to help monitor frogs and toads with Friends of Amphibians. The Southern Wisconsin Bird Alliance, formerly Madison Audubon, led a beginning birding walk at Cherokee. Friends of Owen educated folks about runoff on a stormwater stroll. And Bird Nature Naturalist led a free family-friendly walk about animal adaptations at Turville Point. Coming up this week, there's lots more to enjoy, learn, and do in nature. Kicking it off, my friend, UW Nelson Institute graduate and Wild Warner founder, Trish O'Kane, will present her book, Birding to Change the World, at the Wisconsin Book Festival on Tuesday, March 12th, 7 p.m. at the Madison Central Library, 201 West Mifflin. Come and hear her fascinating stories about experiences in Madison and beyond, and how birds shape and motivate our environmental perspective, followed by a discussion. Books will be available for signing. See more at wisconsinbookfestival.org under events. On Thursday, March 14th at 9 a.m., come to the Arboretum Winter Series at the Visitor Center for Fungi in the Arboretum with Jessica Ross, conservation biologist with the Wisconsin DNR. This talk will focus on an induction to fungi, their ecological importance, and the basics of fungal identification. She will also discuss the results of the Arboretum Fungal Diversity Project, a participatory citizen science initiative, and talk about ways to get started observing and documenting fungi that you see. You can register for this Thursday, March 14th event at arboretum.wisc.edu. Seniors will enjoy the free Thursday, March 14th, 12:15 p.m. Trees in Spring Bird and Nature Adventure at Warner Park Community Recreation Center on Northport Drive, meeting in the senior lunch area. Tree buds are starting to burst. Surgery sap is rising with the coming of spring. Join tree expert Sean Gear for a free, fascinating program about Wisconsin trees, the shapes of buds and leaves that take form, how and why surgery sap rises, and other fun facts. We'll take a short walk if weather permits. Seniors can bring a family friend or family member, and senior groups are invited to help bring seniors and small groups. And the Great Wisconsin Birdathon is back this spring on April 15 to June 15, so it's time to form or join a team, a birdathon team, and have fun finding as many bird species as you can while helping raise funds for the Natural Resources Foundation. Anyone can join a team of at any level, age, or expertise. Registration opens Friday, March 15 at wibirdathon.org. UW students are invited to join UW-Madison Student Audubon Birding Field Trips this Saturday and every Saturday morning. Email audubonsocietyuw@gmail.com to get on the email list and receive weekly outing details and updates. The public is invited to learn more about the fascinating world of fungus among us on Saturday, March 16 at 10 a.m. at Goodman Community Center on Wabisa. Join Michael Rising mushroom enthusiast Aaron Cutler and Recreate. We may take a walk along the bike path to look for examples of fungi growing along Starkweather Creek, learn about making mycorrhizal tea, and enjoy a demonstration of how to grow your own mushrooms. On Sunday, March 17 at 1 p.m., you can enjoy an Arboretum Nature Walk at the Visitor Center located right in the heart of the Arboretum. Learn about the land, plants, and animals on this and other free public naturalist guided Arboretum Nature Walks every Sunday. Global warming is real. What are some changes we are already seeing? You can learn about seasons creep on Sunday, March 17 at 1:30 on a free Bird and Nature Adventure at Warner Park meeting at the Rainbow Shelter, 2930 North Sherman. Naturalist Alex Singer will lead a free, family-friendly guided walk to enjoy the spring equinox and the return of longer days. Is the ice gone earlier or later than usual this year? What plants are starting to green? What birds and wildlife are active? The early advent of spring and the delay of autumn are effects of climate change that are being noticed by more and more people. The differences in temperature and precipitation can positively and negatively affect plants and animals in ways we're only realizing as they play out in real time and the impacts are exposed in the long-term research. More outdoor adventures coming up in March include first flowers of spring at Aldo Leopold Nature Center, a spring equinox walk at Pheasant Branch, and early bird migrants at UW Lakeshore Nature Preserve. You can find details online at cityofmadison.com parks and at tinyurl.com/MadisonFunAdventures. And look on Facebook and Nextdoor at Madison Park, Southern Wisconsin Bird Alliance, Four Lake Sierra, BIPOC Birding Club, Feminist Bird Club, Get Kids Outside, Friends of Starkweather, Wild Warner, and other Madison environmental community and friends groups helping preserve and restore our own urban parks and natural areas in the heart of the city for other living things and opportunities to enjoy nature close up right here in Madison. It's naturally fun.
Thank you, Paul. And I do want to thank, before we we'll get the chance, I want to thank all the folks who donated to this program and other programs during our winter fundraising drive. We had over 1,000 listeners who called in or pledged online. And our on-air drive is over, but if you missed a chance, you can still do that online. You can go to WORTFM.org and donate your generous contribution to WORT. But we're still adding everything up. We think we're pretty close to our goal, but just know that we're very grateful to you, and thanks for partnering with our volunteers to make possible all we do at WORT. And speaking of volunteers and all that we do, our engineer Rudy Nundy, today is his last day with the program. He is moving off to Orlando, and so we appreciate all the work that he's done for us so far and wish him the best and further journeys and further endeavors. And Rudy, you've got a farewell song of the week for us, don't you?
Hey, hello. The song of the week this time is a mashup of songs all the way from 2000 to 2010 by Nikita Afonso.
In addition to the generous support of listener sponsors, the local businesses and organizations that underwrite WORT's programming play a vital role in the financial health of your community radio station. WORT is grateful for the support of our underwriters, and when you visit these businesses and organizations, please let them know that their support of WORT is appreciated. For information on how to become a WORT underwriter, contact me, Doug Holtz, at 608-256-2001 or visit our website at wortfm.org.
Now, 30 years as the EQ guy, and I want you all to tune in on Monday night, March 11th at 7 p.m. for my newest edition of my DJ Les Lusker's Rock Show on the WORT-FM Access Hour. Started following earthquakes, the day of the Northridge earthquake in the Los Angeles area of Southern California on January 17, 1994, and now been a big 30 years of following all seismic activity all around the world. world, as many of you know. And now, featuring my top 10 list of all my favorite songs. Tune in and hear all your old-timey favorite songs right here on the WORT-FM Access Hour when DJ Les Luster's Rock Show returns one more time on the Access Hour. That's Monday, March 11th at 7 p.m., everybody.
If you've ever had to add or multiply two measurements in the imperial or English system together, like 5/8 plus 1/3 of an inch, you may have sworn a curse and wondered why the U.S. hasn't gone metric yet. Metric, of course, has the singular advantage of using decimals, which, as we all know, are far, far easier to use in calculations than are fractions. Decimals seem like they've been around forever, but someone had to invent them. For years, historians credited German mathematician Christopher Clavius with the invention of the decimal point in 1593. Recently, though, new evidence suggests that an Italian merchant had used decimal points as far back as 1441, 150 years earlier than previously thought. Glenn Van Brummelen is Dean of the Faculty of Natural and Applied Sciences and a professor of mathematical science at Trinity Western University in British Columbia. And he joins us now by phone. Welcome to the 8 o'clock buzz.
Thank you so much. Pleased to be here.
So tell us about your discovery and tell us who Bianchini was and why you were looking at his work and what happened when you discovered this thing.
Oh, yes. The actual moment of discovery, it doesn't really happen very often in the history of math that you have these sudden revelations in a text. I was reading a mid-15th century astronomical text that was actually intended by Bianchini to be used for the purpose of horoscopes for astrology. We had seen that there were tables that had dots in them, but that doesn't necessarily mean they were decimal points. So I was teaching at a summer camp for middle school math kids, which I do every year. And in the evening, I was working on this text with a colleague over Zoom, and we came across the passage where he describes exactly what these dots mean. He ends up multiplying 10.4 by 8. And lo and behold, he gets 83.2. So suddenly we realized, yes, those points are actually decimal points. And I got rather excited at that point and grabbed my computer, ran up and down the hallway of the dorm looking for anyone who was still awake. Look, this guy's using decimal points 150 years before they should have been. I think my colleagues thought I was crazy.
So this really was a eureka moment for you. I mean, it's not, as you said, this is a pretty rare thing in mathematics.
Yes, it was. Now, there were other people. There have been a number of different cultures, and even in Europe over the medieval period and during this time and after, who also invented decimal fractions. But every time they did, it would tend, in Europe and in medieval Islam, they would be invented for a purpose, and then they would fade away because they didn't gain traction for something practical. So what happened here was much the same with Bianchini. He invented it, and it didn't really go anywhere until Clavius, 150 years later, rediscovered it. So, in fact, Bianchini didn't make a major impact on his time with this particular discovery, but it planted a seed that was picked up and became the decimal point that we use today.
So, I mean, as we mentioned in the intro, why was this so hard to invent? I mean, why was the idea of, I mean, we've, you know, most of us, at least since the Babylonians anyway, have been using a base 10 system for most things for a long time. I mean, that sort of mathematics mm-hmm. is very old. Why did it take so long to come up with this idea of extending that to the other side of, you know, the other side of one?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I'm speaking to an American audience here. You folks should be the most easily understood why this can take a while, because when you live within an existing system, you don't necessarily question it. It feels natural to you. When you're working with something that you've used since you were very young. You don't necessarily question it because it's smooth for you. It's continuous. It's something that's just part of your background, and you may not even see the need to replace it. So this discovery would have been not entirely convincing to being even Bianchini's colleagues in astrology. Some of what Bianchini did get transmitted later. One of them, you might remember your high school trigonometry, one of the tables that he uses the decimal point for turns out to be the beginning of a historical trail that leads to the tangent function that we all use in school. So it's quite a story. This amazing man in the 1440s and 1460s with such creativity just seems to come out of nowhere. I had actually been hoping when picking Bianchini to study to try to find out what was his source of inspiration. My suspicion had been that these ideas that he was getting had come from Islamic sources, from Arabic texts. But, you know, it hasn't turned out that way. He seems to have just been a natural genius in many ways. These ideas came from his own creative mind.
So Bianchini, as you mentioned, was an astrologer, but he was also a merchant. First off, how do those things go together? And then was that background, did that lead him in different directions from other more classically trained mathematicians of his era?
Oh, it certainly did. He had an unusual background. We know that he was a Venetian merchant. Venice is actually just about an hour and a half away from Ferrara, where he ended up working later. He ended up as an administrator of the Duchy of Ferrara. So he would have been trained in mercantile mathematics. And so the mathematics he used was quite different from what university-trained astronomers would have used. They would have used base 60. So when he became the administrator, one of his tasks would have been to cast horoscopes for the court at Ferrara. And it became clear very quickly reading his texts that although he may not have cared a lot for astrology, he certainly loved the mathematics. And that's what made him so unique, was that he brought the mercantile mathematics into the astronomy. He actually rewrote part of the great work of astronomy at the time, Ptolemy's Almagest, starting it off using exactly the pattern of his likely training as a merchant. So so that naturally led into using decimal number systems in his astronomy. And from there, it transmitted to the great 15th century astronomer Regiomontanus. And from there, it spread to all of us.
So let's back up a second. You mentioned that most astronomers at that time were using a base 60 system. Why was that? And how did that come about?
Oh, that goes back all the way to the culture you mentioned originally, the Babylonians. Ancient Babylonian mathematics was in base 60. It probably emerged from a system of weights and measures more than 4,000 years ago. And it's the way that we tell time today comes from that. Hours, minutes, and seconds. Until very recently, we used to measure angles the same way as degrees, minutes, and seconds. The astronomers continued to use base 60 after what we now call the decimal point continuously from ancient Greece through the Arabic period and also in Europe. It's very difficult to use it in some ways. And, you know, if I could go back and tell Ptolemy, why not you just switch to base 10, things would be so much easier, I would do that, but I can't do that. If you're going to be doing the kind of mathematics you need for this astronomy, you're frequently having to multiply and divide these numbers together. And just imagine, remember the long multiplication you learned in school. when you do that long multiplication, you have to memorize everything up to 9 times 9 to be able to make the method work. Well, imagine you're in base 60. You then have to know by heart everything up to 59 times 59. So you actually will find these medieval tables that are very large multiplication tables. And what the medieval European astronomers would often do is to convert everything to the smallest unit and multiply those. So for instance, if you're going to multiply, say to find the area of a field, you want to multiply 5 feet, 3 inches by 8 feet, 9 inches. The way you do it, if you're a medieval astronomer, is you convert everything into inches, do the multiplication, and then convert back. It was just the common practice. And if I could explain why they didn't adjust that, I'd also have an explanation for why Americans don't use the metric system today.
And of course, we do use the metric system. It's just not all the time, right?
I mean, I'm sorry. We Canadians just love to poke fun of Americans when we get our chance.
There's ample opportunity. So what is this discovery that the decimal point is older than we thought, that it came out of Italy instead of Germany, and perhaps was influenced, you know, from things earlier than that? What does that tell us about the history, our understanding of the history of mathematics in the medieval and early Renaissance period?
Well, here I'm going to downplay my own discovery. It actually doesn't tell us a lot about what happened between 1440 and 1590, because we know that Bianchini's method wasn't picked up in that time. And history of math is about what people were using and practicing. So it does provide a link backward, and it helps us to answer a question that we don't often get answers to when we are in our mathematics classes. I mean, have you ever been in a math class and wondered, why am I learning this? Where did this come from? I mean, how did humans even think of such things like the quadratic formula or trigonometry or whatever? Well, this story allows us to say more specifically where the decimal number system came from. It came from this measurement instrument that he had designed to be able to calculate altitudes and distances. And he needed it for his astrological calculations, which tells us that mathematics comes from and is inspired by all sorts of practical applications out there in the world. The mathematics comes from the physical world. It isn't imposed on it. And I think that's probably the biggest value of this story, just to allow us to become more aware that mathematics emerges from daily concerns.
All right. We've been speaking with mathematical science professor Glenn Van Bremelen. Thank you so much for joining us on the 8 o'clock buzz.
Thank you.
Some days it's hard to see. If I was a fool or you a thief, made it through the maze to find my one in a million. And now you're just a page torn from the story I'm living. And all I gave you.
It's 10 minutes to 9. You're tuned to the 8 o'clock buzz on WORT. This is Brian Standing. Well, when we invite guests who've never been here before to the WORT studios at 118 South Bedford Street, we always say it's a multicolored building with the WORT logo on the side. You can't miss it. The 1980s era mural adorning our humble studio is so distinctive, it was recently replicated in a model train exhibit at the Alliant Energy Center. Well, famous though it may be, 35 years of Wisconsin weather have left the paint a bit the worse for wear, and it's time for a new design. Phil Ryan sits on the WORT Board of Directors and is the chair of WORT's Mural Project Committee, and he joins us now to tell us more. Welcome to the 8 o'clock buzz, Phil.
Hi, Brian. How are you doing?
Good. So let's start by talking a little bit about how the current mural came to be. It's certainly distinctive. It's got a old tube radio over the door and some instruments flying around. How did that happen?
So I was not part of WORT in the late 1980s when that mural was applied to the exterior. However, my understanding from looking into the history of the mural is that it was very much a collaborative, community-driven effort with people coming together and actually applying the plate themselves. I believe there's an anecdote about the mayor at the time, Paul Soglin, applying the first brush stroke of paint to sort of kick off the effort.
And so it's been there for 35 years. How did the board of directors decide it was time for a change?
It was really driven by a former board member, Pat Sable. And I've worked with him for about 6 months now, and I'm still not entirely sure that I'm pronouncing his last name right. But Pat really sort of took this effort on to heart and was in large way a big driver of the push to finally get around to updating the exterior of the building and improving the look of the building.
So you've got an open submittal for submissions for ideas of what the exterior of the WORT building could look like. How can people submit their ideas?
So on the WORT website, there is a page where you can not only learn more about the current mural and the plans to update it, but actually apply by, it's a web-based form, and I believe you can submit attachments of examples of your work, and if you have any brief thumbnail sketches from your artist notebook or, something that you're just thinking of off the top of the head, you can attach those as well. And we will be collecting submissions through the 25th of March, and then the committee will be getting together to go over all those and ask for a few finalists to submit more detailed proposals with a budget and design work.
And what criteria are you looking for in a mural? I mean, when you're going to be evaluating these things, how do you separate something that you go, oh, that's good, versus maybe not?
Well, that is actually a very interesting question, because as I'm sure everyone knows, artistic taste is extremely subjective, and there is no universal criteria for saying this is the best piece of art. Art speaks to everyone on an individual basis, and so I think the final determination will be challenging. But like you referred to earlier, WORT is a very collaborative, community-driven enterprise, and I think people that care about this can ultimately come to a decision that should satisfy everyone and hopefully thrill everyone.
And for artists who are contemplating submitting something, are there any guidelines at all, or is the sky the limit?
The sky really is the limit. One of the funding sources that we're hoping to help with this project, the City of Madison, offers a facade improvement grant, and that specifies that the exterior of the building can't be advertising related. So the only real limitation is that it can't just be a big mural that says WORT is the best or something along those lines.
But it is the best. That's an objective fact. So,
well, that is certainly the case. But in this particular instance, I don't think the funding will let us pursue that. So really, we're just hoping for a vibrant, visually exciting design that can catch people's attention and present WORT in a positive, colorful light.
And who's on the selection committee?
That is a collection of volunteers and WORT board members and staff. It is such a long and fluctuating list. I'm not sure I can mention anyone by name. I know Pat Sable and Jonathan Cooper, a sometimes radio host, are spearheading a lot of the local contact business people, asking for donations from the business community. Charlie Pittman, your own news director, has helped us tremendously. I believe the board president, Stu Leviton, will be speaking with the local media in Madison in the upcoming week. So it's we've had artists, we've had people with no real experience, all sort of coming together to help this project along.
And then for the final selection of the final mural, what kind of budget do you have, and will artists be compensated for their time?
So the initial call to artists right now, we are not able to compensate artists because actually we have no idea what people are going to be sending us. And at this stage, it's really more of a winnowing job application type process. However, once we do select finalist applicants to submit a specific design proposal, there is a compensation that we have already begun fundraising for, and that money is set aside. As for the overall budget, that is really what part of this process is designed to help us with. We don't know how much it will cost to find an artist that can paint the exterior of the building. And so our fundraising goal at this point is anywhere from $40,000 on up.
All right. We've been speaking with Phil Ryan, chair of the WORT Mural Project Committee. You have until March 25th to submit your ideas for a new WORT mural at wortfm.org/mural-project. Final selections will be made in April of 2024. Phil Ryan, thank you for joining us on the 8 o'clock Buzz.
Thanks. Take care.
And that wraps up our program for today. I'd like to thank our guests, Wisconsin Watch reporter Jacob Resnick, mathematician Glenn Van Brummelen, and WORT Mural Project Committee Chair Phil Ryan. Thanks to our producer, Nicholas Wooten, and our receptionist, Marla Raboviak. And a fond farewell to our engineer, Rudy Nandi, who piloted the mighty WORT soundboard and spun the great tunes for the last time today. We wish Rudy well as he decamps for Orlando, Florida. If you think you have what it takes to take the helm, push the buttons, and slide the faders that keep us on the air, please contact Charlie Pittman at charlie@wortfm.org. This is WORT 89.9 FM Madison. We are live streaming and podcasting at wortfm.org. My name is Brian Standing. Global Revolutions is coming up next, right after the Insurgent Radio Kiosk.
This is the Insurgent Radio Kiosk for Monday, March 11th.
MedMen here for Action Weirdos Productions. This week in music history for March 11th. A little music quiz for you today. Here's a bunch of songs. Try to guess what they have in common.
Hey, a little less conversation, a little more action.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
I hear the sound of a gentle on the wind that lifts her perfume through the air.
All those songs, along with thousands of others, including 150 top 10 U.S. hits and 40 number one singles, have Harold Simon Belsky in common. Better known as Hal Blaine, he was a session drummer and the most recorded studio drummer in music history. He coined the name and was a member of the Wrecking Crew, a collective of U.S. session musicians responsible for many studio recordings in the 1960s and 70s. Older musicians felt that the group's embrace of rock and roll was going to wreck the music industry. Bruce Gary, drummer for The Knack, said he was surprised and a little disappointed to find that his top 10 favorite drummers all turned out to be Hal Blaine. Hal played on 6 consecutive Grammy-winning albums of the year between 1966 and 1971, and is credited with popularizing